The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and everyone else for having me today. What I'm doing is asking you to indulge me because I'm working on a book, and I've been working on it since 2014, and it's killing me. It's almost ready to kind of... I'm at the point where you do all the annoying stuff you have to do for publishers. So the book is a book about stories and about the Christian story. So essentially I go through the three kind of major genres of world literature: tragedy, comedy, and epic. And my underlying thesis is that each of these, actually these genres, actually is a theology, actually has a bunch of hidden or sometimes explicit theological commitments. Not Christian theological commitments, but they make religious or theological or metaphysical statements about human being and where human beings are in the world. And so what I'm doing is then hosting a conversation between the two theologies, Christian theology and the theology of each of the genres. So available from Fortress Press for a very reasonable price, coming to you in the new year. All good bookshops, blah, blah. So today I want to talk about tragedy and Christianity under that sort of rubric that I've done. And I value your comments and questions, of course, because it's a work in progress. And that is also my apology for any sketchiness, because it is a work in progress and my thoughts are developing still. So I begin with a tragedy that occurred on June the 12th, 2016, when a young man walked into a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, and killed 49 and wounded 58 people. It was the Pulse nightclub. And after this particular incident, as with many incidents, tragic incidents in the world at large at the moment, we saw the media commentary and the popular commentary taking a particular form. We saw the habit of people trying to narrate or coming to narrate the story that had happened, the events that had happened, into moral meaningfulness, partly to enable response and action. So you got the gay hate narrative, that this was a gay hate hate crime. You got the gun control narrative, because this was an example of a man who had access to guns who clearly shouldn't have. You got the this is an ISIS terrorist narrative, or the Islamophobic narrative. And along with this, so these competing narratives over one incident occurred. Along with this, we had people sending their thoughts and their prayers. None of the ways of telling this story felt to me as if they actually fit the totality of what had occurred. The word tragedy was kind of bandied about, but then it doesn't really kind of do it justice to reduce it to any of the stories that I've depicted here. Now, tragedy is a word that we still need. Tragedy is a word which, from the literary world, which describes a sort of eradicable human experience, a human experience that we cannot avoid, that experience of suffering and death and loss and grief. And the word tragedy actually allows us to sit in the dust and to recognize the agony of others and to realize that we're both in solidarity with the victims and complicit with the perpetrators. It actually exceeds any of those little stories, those little politicized narratives that I described earlier. The English writer Sir Philip Sidney, writing in The Age of Shakespeare, he said, "But tragedy teacheth the uncertainty of this world, and upon how weak foundations gilden roofs are builded." Tragedy teaches the uncertainty of this world, and upon how weak foundations gilden roofs are builded. Tragedy in life and in literature gives us the sense of uncertainty about the world. It is not about closure. In fact, it's about saying we don't understand. It is just sad and inexplicable. It helps us to feel the two emotions that Aristotle said were key to tragedy, and those are fear and pity. Pity for those who suffer, or pathos, and fear that we may share their fate. So pity and fear, those two key emotions, which aren't sort of reducible to kind of neat political explanations. So what might Christian theology say in response to tragedy? Is tragedy then the only thing that we're left with in human life? Does it all end in tears? And as I said before, I want to kind of host a conversation between these two narratives, the Christian narrative and the narrative of tragedy that is so deeply embedded in our culture and also something we seem to need. So what is the theology of tragedy? And what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, tragic human beings inhabit a moral universe, even when they can't see how it is. When we call something a tragedy, whether we're watching a tragedy, the tragedy of Othello, or we see an event in the public eye and we call it a tragedy, we are implicitly saying there is a sort of meaningfulness in the universe. It's not meaningless, but I can't grasp it, or we can't grasp it. Our tears are deeply theological. When we grieve at the plight of other human beings, we say, look, it all connects and it's worth weeping for. If there is no meaning, if there is only if life is, to use the immortal words of Homer Simpson, just a bunch of stuff that happens, then our tears are sort of are pointless. They're kind of just a biological response we should get over. If there is not a falling short of some good, then the tragic effect doesn't exist. We don't actually have that word. It kind of falls away. To call something a tragedy is to say that it's meaningful, but to also name a sort of mystery about it and a distance from it. So we sit here in pity and fear. We understand that there is meaning, but we don't know, we don't grasp it. It belongs to whatever force is guiding human events. That's the first thing about the theology of tragedy, that tragedy says we inhabit a moral universe. Secondly, the tragic human being is invited to free action, but finds their freedom deeply compromised. And so tragedy names the fact, this mystery in human life, that we're both free and not free, that we're called to free action and responsibility, and yet when we do act, we find that our actions are sort of compromised everywhere by other things around us. We're called to act, but it is, as Hegel once said, a sin to act. Action involves responsibility, and yet when we act, we also then we then become culpable. We're called to act freely, but find that we're not free. We find that suffering and death are inevitable in this universe, in tragedy. Just think of the great tragedies of Shakespeare and how this is true in those narratives. The human being is invited to free action and yet finds that he or she is not actually free because of the forces that surround them. The third thing, so that's the sort of, we're caught in this vice of wanting to act freely and take responsibility and yet finding that events grind us. Thirdly, the human being in the tragic story is both a victim and a perpetrator. I think this is one of the great huge insights of tragedy, that you find that we don't have in the great tragedies of Shakespeare once more, we don't have people who are just hapless victims. I mean, Hamlet is not a hapless victim. He's also a perpetrator of the events that tear him down. And yet he's also a victim, so we feel sorry for him. A person is just a victim. That's not in one sense a classic tragedy. That's just a disaster. And a person who's just evil, well, again, even Macbeth, who's pretty evil, is not just a perpetrator. He's also a victim of the events that surround him. So that's one of the great sort of the great kind of insights of tragedy. Oedipus, great tragedy of Sophocles. You find that he kills his father and marries his mother. You might remember, according to a promise, a prophecy that had been uttered over him. Now, he does so without knowing that his mother is his mother and his father is his father, and yet it is his violence and his lust for power and his lust that take him to this action. So he is both the victim and the perpetrator. The word that the tragedians used was the word hamartia, which is interestingly also a biblical word for sin, and it named the tragic flaw. You remember the tragic flaw that's in a character? It names that the tragic person, says that the tragic person is both victim and perpetrator. Fourthly, the tragic protagonist is a representative figure. And so what we see in tragedy is a person who in some way represents us all. For Aristotle, in particular, it had to be a noble person. And that's why tragedies worked, because just as in the politics of yore, the royal figure was a sort of some way the representative of us all, likewise in tragedy a noble figure had to be the centre of the tragedy. Interestingly, in the 20th century, this is challenged by Arthur Miller, the age of democracy, and we have in Death of a Salesman. Does anyone remember the name of the lead figure, the protagonist? It's Willie Lowman, right, which I think is quite deliberate. He's saying this is the tragedy of democracy. He's a nobody, not a somebody. Like Othello is a somebody, Willie Lowman is a nobody, but representative. And so, in one sense, they're summoned. We witness them in a sort of substitutionary or a sacrificial role, and we see that their tragedy happens in order to maintain peace and order. You see that in Othello. He dies in order that the peace of Venice be restored, because it's been thrown into such imbalance by his presence. So fifthly, in tragedy, human suffering has the potential, again, an interesting flip side to the process of tragedy. In tragedy, the process of human suffering actually has the potential to be redemptive and restorative. Blood being shed is sometimes punitive, it's sometimes retributive, it's sometimes restorative, so that the suffering of the person in the tragedy, in the end, achieves some greater good. It is, at one level, the death of the central figure is healing, at least a little bit. What the classic narrative shape of the tragedy, as I was taught it at university, is if you've got a comedy, it goes like that, in a U shape, as in you go from happy to sad to happy, or from order to chaos to order. In tragedy, you go from order to chaos, and then you head up a little bit at the end. There's a sort of nice little hook at the end, pointing towards order that will be restored. So that's my five points about tragedy, the theology of tragedy. Tragic human being inhabits a moral universe. Tragic human being is invited to free action, but finds that he or she is not actually free, bound about by forces out of his or her control. The tragic human being is a victim and a perpetrator. The tragic protagonist is a representative figure, and in tragedy, human suffering has the potential to be redemptive and restorative. So why don't you just absorb that? I'm going to take a drink. So what might Christian theology say in response to tragedy? So I have 6 points in response. The first one is that, and some of these are to agree, of course, with tragedy, or to follow trains of thought that tragedy prompts. So, first of all, human beings are the culpable victims of their own failure to be most truly themselves. So, human beings, just as in tragedy, we are named as victims and perpetrators, likewise, Christian theology, the story of the Christian scriptures, names human beings as pitiable, but also blameworthy. So that human beings are neither just innocent victims, but they are victims. They are caught in the vice of their own making. And so this condition is brought about because of a falling short, just as it was in tragedy, just as it is in tragedy. In fact, sin is described in the Bible as a falling short of the glory of God. And so this falling short of God's glory leads us into this culpable victimhood. That paradox, but it, I think, a meaningful paradox. We are the culpable victims of our own failure. Secondly, what about this idea of human free action? Christian theology would say that human free action is compromised by the condition of being in Adam, that there is an enslavement of the human will, that we are called to free action, but at the same time unable to be the beings that we are called to be. We find ourselves not doing what we would do. Paul, in this wonderful passage from Romans 7, says, which is it is a little bit confusing, just read on the page, but makes perfect sense, the good I would, I do not do. And that I would not do, I do. I mean, I think that sums up the human condition, if you can untangle the grammar of it. Very well. We are called to free, we feel free, and yet we don't. We somehow don't do that even that we would do. So thirdly, human suffering is potentially redemptive and restorative. Tragedy, we're Christians though, might say that tragedy does not protest loudly enough here. There is perhaps in tragedy too, that little hook at the end is not enough. At one level, tragedy just says that suffering and death are inevitable, but also insurmountable. You can't get around them. There's no gainsaying them. There's no comeback from them. They have this inevitability, and tragedy just says, and necessity, and tragedy just says, you better get used to it because this is what life is like. Hopefully, we can rescue some kind of good from the ashes. Suffering in Christian thought is a sign of judgment, but in Christ we find those sufferings turn to an eschatological purpose. The wounds of Jesus are intended to destroy him, and yet by his stripes we are healed. His death, then, is not a tragedy. That's quite crucial for Christian thinking, is that even though at the centre of Christian thinking there is the death of the central figure, it looks like a tragedy, and yet it isn't in the end a tragedy. It doesn't bypass Jesus' death, but it goes through his death and then to the resurrection. His death achieves this restoration of humankind. There was a divine experience of tragic suffering, but then a divine victory over the experience of tragic suffering. So that I think at this level, Christianity does not deny tragedy, but goes beyond and through tragedy. That's important, I think. You could see a religion that denies that suffering has any meaning at all, or that suffering is there. So there are religions that, in fact, deny suffering outright, or pretend. Or you could imagine a religion that denies, or says that if you suffer, then it's somehow because of your lack of faith or your lack of obedience. Whereas Christianity says, yes, suffering exists, suffering is, we all face it, but God experiences suffering and comes out the other side of it too. On the cross we see a God-forsaken God, not crushed by the necessity of suffering and death, but embracing them to reveal their impermanence. In fact, the New Testament will talk about how Jesus parades in triumph the forces of evil in the end, in the cross, triumphs over them by his cross, which looks tragic but is not. So fourthly, the divine plan is revealed in Jesus Christ and yet remains concealed. You know how I said the tragic hero sits there saying, this is tragic, it's meaningful somewhere, the gods are doing something here, I'm not sure what it is. There's a similarity there with Christian thought. Christians, we say that we human beings aren't given the blueprints of the universe by God, but we are, because of who God is, we do know that he is a planning God, a sovereign Lord who overrules. In his hands are all things. And yet when we hear Paul talk about this in a famous passage from Romans chapter 11, right at the end there, he doesn't sound like he's delivering a tragic soliloquy. He doesn't sit there sounding like King Lear, saying to the gods we are like flies, they are like wanton boys, says King Lear. I'm messing up the quote here. They pluck us for their sport. In other words, you know, boys are sitting there kind of torturing flies, and he imagines the gods doing that to human beings. That's not what we see Paul doing in Romans 11. In Romans 11, he's saying, oh, the mystery, the unsearchable ways of God, and yet he ends in a note of praise and triumph there. The fact that we don't understand God's ways is not a cause for despair, it's a cause for rejoicing, because of who God is. So he actually rejoices in the mystery of the divine plan because of what God has revealed in his character, because in the history that the Bible narrates, God is not just mystery and distance, but is also closeness and revelation. And because God, of course, reveals himself in Christ, makes himself known to us, so we understand not the detail of God's plan, but the significant part of God's plan, and we understand his character. We see, of course, in the covenant in the Old Testament that this God is a God who binds himself to human beings. Extraordinary thing, this idea that the gods are not up there fighting one another and occasionally coming down, raping human beings and doing whatever, as in Greek mythology, but actually what we have is a God who binds himself through his own promises and by his own character to human beings. And so human beings are not then held in a vice of the necessity and the inevitability of suffering and death, wondering what the gods have in store, but have hope, a true hope, even in the midst of tragedy. As Paul says in Romans 8, if God is for us, who can be against us? Could a tragic hero ever say that? Because, of course, the answer is, it's a rhetorical question. If God is for us, well, yes, he is for us. Who can be against us? No one. A tragic hero might say, well, if God was for us, but I have no idea whether he is or not, or who he is even. So that's the divine plan revealed in Christ and yet remains mysterious, and yet that's not a sign of despair for Christians. It's a sign of hope. Fifthly, the God of Jesus Christ invites his creatures into a conversation with him, which includes protest. What's one of the most amazing things about the scriptures? Of course, you might say that God actually protests against human beings and says, well, you human beings have got a lot to answer for. But it's also the case that throughout the scriptures, we see the voice of human beings turned in protest towards God, and yet that is God allowing human protest as part of what is said to be his speech. You see this in the book of Job, of course, but in Psalm 118 and the other protest psalms, lament psalms as well. This remarkable feature of the Bible that it includes these protests. God, where are you? What are you doing? That sort of voice of protest being God's own voice. This human, but of course then, again, the cross. On the cross we see Jesus calling out, why have you forsaken me? My God, why have you forsaken me? A divine protest against God, you might say, in our ears, a recognition that the human experience is so fraught and that he shares it. So then, lastly, in Jesus Christ, we see a form of life that in hope transcends tragedy. And we see that, just trying to figure out what my notes mean here, in hope, Jesus Christ then absorbs the tragic, and then turns it to this terrific Christian word, hope, which says that pain and suffering are not denied, the experience of loss and grief are not denied, but that they, in the midst of those, we have hope. Now I think these thoughts partly because I'm a person who has to carry out quite a few funerals. And so I do go to the bedsides of people who are dying, and I do address people who are in the midst of great loss. And one of the things about modern funerals is that, particularly at a church like St. Mark's, where lots of people have a kind of thank connection, but they're not particularly Christian, so they'll bring their whatever they have to the table. And one of the things at the funeral is that people have songs sung and have readings read that are actually, I think, tragic and despairing. They offer no hope at all. You know, I'm in the next room. Don't weep for me. Well, I want to weep for you. It's a great loss. They're either a denial of the tragic, or they are deeply hopeless. In fact, we had a song sung at a funeral recently by a grandchild, and the song was very beautifully done, but it was basically, there is no hope, death is the end. So it was a bit of a teenage angst song, but beautifully done. My job is to say, try and say meaningful things from a Christian framework here, and I think I really can. I think I feel marvellously blessed by the Christian perspective in that situation of being able to say, name what is truly there, the pain that people are experiencing, and yet speak words of hope because of what Christ offers in his death and resurrection, both a God who absorbs and experiences tragedy, but turns tragedy into hope. And so I don't think it ends in tears, or it needn't end in tears, but the tears we weep are worth weeping. We can still weep them. We don't need to wipe them away here, because we recognise the reality of the world in which we live. In researching this, I found a video where it goes back to the 70s, because Richie Beno was a great commentator. Let's just say he was he's the doyen of cricket commentators, and he rarely overused words. He rarely kind of upped the scale. But in the 1970s, I found this clip, and it was from the BBC. And Derek Randall, you might remember, and Geoffrey Boycott are batting, 1977, and Geoffrey Boycott runs out Derek Randall, the other English batsman, and it's at Nottingham, which is Derek Randall's home ground, and he'd just come back into the team. And it's a horrendous run out. And Beno says, "Oh, what a tragedy for England." That's not a tragedy. I mean, he would later say, that is not a, that's an overuse of this word. Tragedies are not run outs, they're calamities and mistakes, but they're not tragedies. And so it's interesting to see that word used in popular culture and in the media. When is it applied well, and do we understand it? I think often one of the things I would say in response to the Orlando tragedy, for instance, is that the Orlando shooting, is that the word, what happens is people say it's a tragedy, but then they rush to explain it and find blame. Whereas I think the word tragedy says to us, very useful, it says, let's just weep. And maybe that's the first reaction, and maybe you do the kind of investigation into the who was to blame and why was this caused. Rushing to do that sort of, well, this was an issue of gun control, or it's an issue of Islamic immigration, or it's an issue of gay hate, that's too fast. We love to go there too fast these days because we want someone to blame all the time, whereas we need to pay attention. Tragedy allows us to pay attention to those who are at the centre of the tragedy, of the events that have occurred, I think. So it's useful that way. So we've got a question here. Other narratives around modern tragedies, like the Pulse nightclub, are anger and blame, or even it wouldn't happen to me. What do I think? That emotion of anger is an interesting emotion, and in particular it's inflamed by our current culture, our internet culture. Maybe we were all these sort of angry trolls before, but now we really know that we're these angry trolls, and we love to we politicize and we make things a result of the culture wars, etc. We kind of take sides on those things, and I think what I just said really it needs to be something we can model is the moment of pause when a disaster occurs. An addressing of victims, and then later a kind of addressing, attending to the causes of these. The denial, it wouldn't happen to me, thing. I think the thing about tragedy, as I said, pity and fear, the effects of watching tragedy are supposed to, I think, draw us in and say, well, in a small scale, because I'm not a noble figure, that could happen. That could happen to me. Fear is an important emotion, one we should, again, not deny, but recognise. Of course, fear can dominate you, and I think the Christian gospel helps us here because it doesn't leave us in fear. It recognises, again, fear, but it doesn't leave us in fear. It gives us a place to find security, even in the midst of calamity and evil. So I think the "it wouldn't happen to me" classic Western denial is, again, the word tragedy kind of might break it open for us. Others might like to come back on that. I hope this isn't too much like revisiting your Year 12 English class. That might have been a happy experience for you or not, but there you go. How do people respond differently to natural tragedy as opposed to society, like bushfires, as opposed to society tragedy, i.e. terrorists? One level, a terrorist action is not a tragedy. It's just an evil act, isn't it? It's not quite the classic tragedy of of literature that we see. I think, how do people respond differently? At one level, we do immediately look for someone to blame. So when it comes to natural tragedies, we start to say, well, there should have been early warning systems, and there should have been, you know, it's because of government corruption that this bushfire occurred, or they didn't backburn enough, or whatever it is. And I think sometimes we forget to say the true thing is actually nature is bigger than us, and sometimes we get in the way of nature's processes. So I think there's a similarity in terms of trying to find blame, and that's not always helpful. So, interestingly, with natural tragedy in Australia, we love to then applaud each other for our virtue in response to the tragedy. So we love to say, Australians, we just volunteer. We pitch in, we roll up our trouser legs, and we get in the flood water, and we help each other. And you wouldn't find us looting or anything like that, which is actually not true. But, you know, so we love to kind of virtue signal in response to that. That certainly happened when the Brisbane floods occurred. You know, it's great to have a politician interviewed with, you know, in knee-deep water while he's kind of visiting, etc. And I love that. Now, how does your Christian response to tragedy challenge the prevailing zeitgeist? Well, I think some of the things I've already said are there. I think it says that tragedy... We've kind of got two responses. One is denial, and one is just despair. And Christianity says definitely not denial, but it also says there's a path through despair to the other side, to hope. And hope is not just, oh, we're all going to get along someday, if only we can get our politics right. This hope is something else. This hope is actually a divine approach to us. It's actually something that God does for us, rather than just the hope that human beings can one day be a great big melting pot and all get along, which it is a kind of, you know, that's a sort of vain wish. You have denial and you have despair, and I think in the middle, or you have abject fear and terror. I think some of the commentary about Islamic terrorism, for instance, and we're, of course, let's be real here. We are meters away from what happened just a couple of years ago. So let's not be blind to the fact that an Islamic linked action happened there. But some of the responses I think have been fearful, and in a way that's kind of what terrorists are aiming to achieve. I think we can be strong and confident and hopeful, not denying the reality. I think that's the habit of the besetting sin of the left, to deny that there's a problem, right? The besetting sin of the right is to whip up fear, and I think somehow a Christian response would be not denial, but actually, there isn't evil, there is a problem, but we need not act out of fear here. I think there's a model there that could be useful for us, and it's to do with the tone of our responses. So there's a person I know who would share a more right-leaning response to Islamic immigration here in Australia and fear about terrorist action and what's happening to Christians overseas. But his response has been to sponsor a bunch of Muslim girls in Australia to go on Outward Bound courses. And I think that is the right response to the emotion that is produced. That goes beyond, of course, thinking about tragedy, but that's challenging the prevailing zeitgeist, those two emotions. So, now how do alternate theologies intersect with the tragic genre? That's a fascinating question. And because originally tragedy was extremely a religious thing, it was a pagan festival. The word tragedy actually comes from the sacrificial goat. That was sacrificed at the festival. They have dramatic festivals that would go for days and days, a little like Wagnerian operas. And you'd sit there and they'd compete with their different plays. There's a couple of interesting things, I think, to talk about atheism. In the literature of the absurd, and we're talking about Waiting for Godot, Samuel Beckett and what have you, you see, Waiting for Godot is not a tragedy. It's not a comedy either. It's a sort of, I went to a Beckett play not long ago, and it's supposed to be funny, apparently. People say it's funny. Endgame, it was called. But it was actually just really boring. But the audience was sort of doing this knowing laughs, you know, trying desperately to laugh. This is the knowing laugh. Just when something was supposed to be funny, it was just kind of boring and disturbing. And I think that's the effect that Beckett kind of wanted. In a godless universe, comedy itself being extremely moral, by the way, in a godless and ethicsless universe, you have then no reason to cry. You just have this disturbing, dark humour. That's humour of a kind. I think that's where atheism takes you. Protest atheism, which is the sort of lament, the tone you pick up from the Bible, as sort of laments, which actually sort of shakes its fist at God. It's in one sense a concession that God exists. It's just we don't like what he's doing. So you get that in a stream of atheism, but I think it's a kind of acknowledgement that God exists, because if he doesn't exist, why do you care that he's not here? And you get this in some of those comedians, actually. So Eddie Izzard's biography I've just read, it's a fascinating biography. If he says, "I don't believe in God," once, he says it 50 or 60 times in his biography, his autobiography. And his reason for God not existing is not philosophical. It's because God didn't stop his mother dying when he was six. And that's a protest. But it's not an argument against the existence of God. It's actually not atheism, I don't think. It's just, God, I'm really outraged, and so I'm turning my back on you. So that's a different type of atheism, isn't it? Now, Islam and Buddhism, I actually don't know enough about either to comment. However, I would say the approach to suffering and the approach to fate in these two faiths is different. So in Islam, extremely fatalistic religion, and so a very highly deterministic, but at the same time, Allah is sort of irascible, and you never know quite where you stand with him. So that's the sort of bind that they have there. But I don't know. It'd be fascinating to know how Islamic commentators comment on tragedy. In Buddhism, of course, suffering is caused by attachment. And so the response to tragedy is not to weep, but to detach. You can't have compassion. Compassion is an extremely Christian virtue. This is one of the... I think we need to kind of keep saying this because of the way people talk about religion. They say, isn't love at the heart of all religions? The answer is definitely not. Love is a distinct... Compassion especially, a distinctively Christian. And Edwin Judge has probably told you this already. A distinctively Christian virtue that we now project onto other religions. Because in other religions, and in Stoicism, for instance, it's your detachment that's important, not your attachment. As Christianity says, no, we need to sit in the dust and weep with those who weep, not detach ourselves from those. It actually makes us, it's far riskier, because it asks us to sit alongside those who weep. There's one more question. Have we got time for that one? So this one says, it's actually in two parts. Does St. Paul's life and journey provide a sort of anti-tragedy where he undergoes suffering and disaster, then martyrdom, without much of an upside, but that we only understand it as part of God's plan for salvation? And the answer is definitely yes, and 2 Corinthians is a marvellous epistle for that, because he talks about comfort and consolation in the midst of tragedy and suffering. His approach to suffering is also Romans 8, key passage where he takes earthly sufferings as a sign of heavenly hope, quite specifically and explicitly. He's not a tragedian, and I wanted to compare him to a tragedian there. Secondly, were the ancient Israelites a tragedy, or were they an epic that humanity needed to provide for the life and mission of Jesus? Come back when I talk about epic in a few weeks' time. But there is a tragic aspect to them, to their history, which I think you find in the sort of literature around the exile. That's sort of a tragedy, and again, those sort of psalms and laments from that period. But there's also delivered into that a note of transformation beyond just kind of, oh, we're going to learn from this experience and get better, but actually a hope for a divine transformation that transcends that tragedy. So it's tragedy transcended, which I think is a great note to finish on.
Thank you very much, Michael.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.